This session is The Sacred and the Mundane, Mormonism on the Internet. The information in here is nothing new to any of us on ELWC, but the fact that it's on the front page of the August 21st, 1995 Provo Daily Herald might be titillating. Unofficial Mormon Ward on Internet. Imagine a ward within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with an almost 80% activity rate, lively homemaking meetings, and members who build up one another in a non-judgmental manner. It sounds like the envy of any bishop, but it has one problem. It cannot be found in the real world. This unofficial unit of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints exists on the Internet, and that in that ethereal realm known as cyberspace. There are no sacrament meetings, but Lynn Anderson, manager of the Electronic Latter-day Women's Caucus mailing list, says the virtual ward that exists on her mailing list provides church contact for those on the margins of the LDS society and a safe haven for working through questions of faith. Anderson, the membership clerk of the virtual ward, said there may come a time when the LDS Church will establish an official presence on the International Computer Network. Anderson began her mailing list 2 years ago to provide an electronic forum to discuss LDS gender issues and feminism in an understanding environment. A lot of people have said this is their only contact with the church. Lists such as ELWC give a place to say what is sometimes difficult in a ward setting, Anderson said. The electronic ward popped into existence shortly after ELWC's creation. As I recall, we were talking about the various positions we held in the church and which callings we didn't like. One woman volunteered to be the nursery leader in the virtual ward. From there, others volunteered or offered the names of those who could be called to different positions in the ward, such as bishop. This is the only ward in the church that is led mostly by women, Anderson said. But there are no sacrament meetings or gospel doctrine classes in this electronic meeting house. What the virtual ward does is reproduce what goes on in the hallways, Anderson said. We go from the heaviest doctrinal discussions to fluff. Nicolette.
I've read about the ward from hell. Is this list that ward, or is the ward from hell only an entity at Sunstone Symposia? Kathy.
I think the ward from hell is an auxiliary of ELWC. Most of us have picked our ward jobs. I guess those who haven't either don't want to belong to the ward or consider themselves the loyal and faithful audience. The rest of us dutifully fulfill our assignments. All I can remember of my job is that somehow I custom designed it to be very sensual and titillating, but I can't remember how. Alta.
Wait, excuse me, but I was under the clear impression that the ELWC equals ward from hell. Julianne.
I have a faint memory of having a calling in the ward from hell months ago, but what it was escapes me. Obviously, I was very diligent in doing it. Steffi.
As the ward from hell's token transsexual, could I be the substitute relief society / priesthood lesson teacher? Just let me know ahead of time so I can dress appropriately. Alex.
You're fairly new to the ward, so you probably don't know much about the structure of the ward from hell. In a nutshell, there is no structure. So you can be what you want. Oh, and you can wear whatever you want, whenever you want to wear it, too. I spend a great deal of time at our ward wearing my chenille bathrobe. Alpha.
Now here's a subject for a dogfight. I find Freud interested in pathologies and Jung in what makes for health. I find Freud rational on the surface, but a captive of his own private mystical mythology, while Jung wallows in a mystic vocabulary but has the clearest sense of scientific objectivity. Roger.
Okay, I'll bite. It's clear to me that it's popular to bash Freud in many circles these days, and I'd admit that Freud is clearly a Victorian and out to lunch on many a specific issue. But at the end of the day, Freud is one of my favorites. Why? Because there is an impulse in his imagination and his writing which keeps him undoing everything he's done. He keeps trying to clean up after himself, but he never can leave things neat. He keeps opening things up. His model has been tremendously enabling for my own personal and professional life, no matter how crazy I go over the details of his stuff along the way. He goes down a line of thought, gives it everything he's got, tries to come to some coherence and peace. But truth, that he can never leave well enough alone. Sure, he's captive, but he knows it, or at least around the edges he knows it, and what more can be expected of any of us? At least in the footnotes, he's on some wild flight of fancy, or telling you it's all bullshit what he's saying. Now, I admit freely I haven't read all that much Jung, but Jung seems to conduce to a belief in truth. And frankly, I'm always deathly afraid of truth. Give me private pathologies and mythologies, as long as there is some admission along the way that the jury is still out. Surely.
6 months ago, I would have laughed at your perception of Freud. But since I've been doing cultural studies, I've seen some amazing twists and turns on Freud and have been really amazed at the discourse. He started by asking the questions he did. Lott used Freud to explain white use of black male bodies in a surprisingly convincing way. Stalybras and White used Freud as a source of cultural change to really important ends, in my opinion. And who can talk about Freud without mentioning Judith Butler's amazing use of Freud to argue for primary homosexuality? Jung's ideas of archetype, coupled with Campbell's monomyth, are extremely structuralist and do posit some sort of universal truth. But like Freud, Jung evolved over his career, and long before the end, he was arguing the archetype as possible metaphor to explain, rather than universal constant. In that regard, Jung made some remarkable strides towards a more postmodern understanding of human psychology. When you talk in myth, you are talking the language of symbols, and the hard part is to remember to always explode or unpack the symbols. In Mormondom, one of the major intellectual problems is the insistence of the one-to-one relationship of symbol to symbolized. It is this literal mindset that makes symbols destructive, reductive, and violent. Our culture doesn't teach us how to work in a field of possibilities. We want reality and truth. Right now, thank you very much. We want to know what the symbols mean. No, what they really mean. Try reading a sacred myth mythically and wait for the backlash. Not long ago, I tried to talk about alternate readings of Eve on another Mormon list, and one guy went into convulsions. Said he, "There is a literal Eve, and this is what literally happened. And if it is a symbol, then this is what it literally means." In my opinion, when you read Mormonism, or any other ism, literally, it will fall apart, slash deconstruct, slash implode. It can be nothing but reductive in this paradigm. But religion becomes beautiful and meaningful after the explosion, when there is no one-to-one relationship with the symbol, but instead there are infinite possibilities. My point is simply that both Jung and Freud can be treated as metaphors to help understand and explain the possibilities of the human psyche to great results. Tad.
Gross everyone out with these creepy cookies. In a bowl, beat together butter, sugar, egg, almond extract, and vanilla. Beat in flour, baking powder, and salt, as indicated below. Cover and refrigerate. Roll heaping teaspoonful of dough into finger shape for each cookie. Press almond firmly into one end for nail. Squeeze in center to create knuckle shape. Using paring knife, make slashes in several places to form wrinkles. Place on lightly greased cookie sheets. Bake at 325, 20 minutes, or until pale golden. Let cool for 3 minutes. Lift up almond, squeeze red decorator gel onto nail, and press almond back in place so gel oozes out from underneath. Oh. Tip, do not forget to take the paring knife and make several wrinkles in the knuckle area. Alpha.
I think there is much we can learn from the RLDS experience of ordaining women. First of all, we can learn that ordaining women is good for women as individuals. It gives women new opportunities to use their own unique God-given gifts in new and expanded ways. It provides new avenues for spiritual growth and development. It encourages deepening spiritual insight, faith, and commitment. Secondly, we can learn that ordaining women is good for women as a class. I dare say that throughout the LDS Church, thousands upon thousands of women, maybe millions, including many who would never dream of calling themselves feminists, feel misunderstood, ignored, and devalued, at least sometimes, in a church where all decisions are made by men, with only as much input from women as these men choose to allow. And even if women don't consciously feel denigrated, they internalize the subconscious message that women are second-class citizens in the household of faith. Exclusion from priesthood affects women's self-esteem. It affects the way men and women and boys and girls value or devalue women's contributions in the church. It creates a problem that can never be solved until women serve in all capacities in the church on an equal basis with men. The third thing we can learn from the RLDS experience is that including women in priesthood callings is good for everyone, men and women alike. At a Sunstone panel I attended nearly 9 years ago, someone during the question and answer period asked whether there was any chance that the RLDS church leadership would change their minds in the future and revert to a males-only policy. A panel member, who was the RLDS high priest group leader, said, Oh, maybe when hell freezes over. He said that women having the priesthood had been such a positive experience for both men and women that there was no way they would go back to excluding women. Fourth, we can learn a much-needed lesson about dealing with diversity and dissent, about conflict resolution, and about pulling together for the common good, even when we don't get our way. It is safe to say that not every RLDS believer was ecstatic about the decision to ordain women. There was significant dissent, and in some places, there still is. While there might not be any one perfect way to resolve every disagreement, the RLDS experience should teach us that people with diverse views need to feel that they have a means of being heard within the church. People who feel they have a fair opportunity to make their voices heard will feel much better about a collective decision, even if their views don't prevail, than a people who have a hierarchical decision imposed on them. Fifth, we can learn that including women in priesthood councils can make those councils more Christ-like and more likely to place a greater value on the needs of people than in the hierarchical corporate values of a church institution. The LDS church leadership has grown ever more obsessive about and insistent on deference and obedience to authority. Evidence of this obsession took on new heights for me a couple of years ago when an apostle, speaking in a general conference priesthood session, urged deference to hierarchy in a number of ways. Included in those ways was the explanation that when members of the Quorum of the Twelve enter a room, each junior member stands aside to allow those senior to him to enter first. He further explained the scriptural precedent for this practice, namely, that on the morning of the resurrection, John outran Peter to the empty tomb, but he waited outside until Peter arrived, so that Peter could enter first. Somehow, missing from this story was the obvious recognition that the first at the tomb and the first in the tomb were women. Also lost on this speaker was the teaching of Jesus that whoever would be the greatest must be the servant of all. Nina.
I personally think that letting women into the hierarchy will achieve nothing but equality in an already corrupt system, an institution that is oppressive and violent by its very nature. Tad.
While this might be true, having power within an institution is still preferable to institutional powerlessness. Lizzie.
Before I could read or bother to, I phonetically assumed Relief Society was the Release Society. So perhaps the Ward from Hell should celebrate the cyber birth of a Release Society, a society dedicated to releasing women from make-work tasks they don't really want to do. We can also celebrate the release from the curious ritual whereby women gather to read and repeat what men say about them. We can vote to release from her calling the doctrinal purity czarina in every ward in the church. All in favor? We can eat Belgian chocolate to release pheromones or whatever brain chemical it is that makes women very, very happy. Nani.
Regarding the founding of the Relief Society, it doesn't matter whether Joseph Smith turned the key on their behalf or turned the key to them. His act still represents the appropriation of female initiative. The irony here is that by bringing the Relief Society under male control, Joseph Smith also gave it and its female leaders increased status in the community. Lizzie.
The core assumption behind 19th century polygamy was that male Mormons would be crowned kings and priests when they entered into their exaltations. The chief metaphor for the measure of dominion this kingship carried was the number of jewels in one's crown. Each wife, each child was another jewel. Now each jewel brought a world, each wifely jewel at least, a world for every wife. Your celestial reward, if you were male, was in direct proportion to the size of your family kingdom on earth. Somewhere in the 20th century, this family kingdom building mentality was left by the roadside. Instead, the nuclear model was bought into lock, stock, and barrel. The mindset of jewels and crowns was lost, as was the ordinance that institutionalized the doctrine and ironically ordained women to the fullness of the priesthood. According to Susan Easton Black, at one point in the last 20 years or so, the church enlisted her help to go through 19th century Mormon sealing records to break all the sealings that weren't parent-child. In other words, Brigham would be sealed to his parents rather than to Joseph, as well as polyandrous sealings. According to Susan, Joseph Smith is now deprived of all wives but Emma, Eliza, and Rachel Ivins, the mother of Heber Grant. And the only reason she wasn't sealed to her husband is because Heber, sealed to Joseph, fulfilled a prophecy that 100 years after the founding of the church, a son of Joseph Smith would be church president. In Joseph's 19th century worldview, this deprives him of the majority of his celestial glory. Crying shame. Late 20th century leaders don't buy into the world for every wife model. I don't think they'll reinstate polygamy. Brad.
Mormons defer to authority, seek their truth from authority, believe from that the authorities will take care of them, and so on. It makes Mormons the ideal pawns in a corporate world, a veritable army of yes people. They are like the fauna of Utah before the white man came, devoid of prickles.
How prickly of you. Seriously, don't you think it depends on the authorities? Nani.
I guess that I have my own personal bias here. I found that these tendencies to defer to authority literally crippled me intellectually. Dan.
These threads have got me wondering about the traits that Mormon culture fosters. It's pretty clear what is officially emphasized, but how close is that to what is actually produced, if one can generalize? For instance, despite the never-ending lessons on decorous helpmate behavior for the girls, increasingly large numbers of young women go on missions, when no one much wants them to, or leave the church, or both. Is that apparent capacity for taking independent action a product of Mormon culture or an erosion from the outside? I'd be interested to hear what folks know about the current lives of the women in particular. Can we do an impressionistic census? Who's the ward demographer anyway? Nani.
About missions. I don't even want to get into the ethics of going or not going. One of the reasons I went was because I anticipated getting married someday and I did not want my husband to be able to hold that over me. I have always fought the urge to make the priesthood equals leadership equals spiritual superiority connection because my father was a bishop and an intellectual, and he always had researched answers to my questions. I wanted to validate my own spiritual strength by serving a mission. I do think that the church desperately needs a woman on the decision-making committee for the missionary program. I never heard so much woman bashing in my life until my mission. The men had this great leadership network in which they were taught to keep those sisters in line and to not let our superior maturity level intimidate them. We had one sisters' conference, the first and the last, the president said, in which we were taught how to dress, accessorize, and glamorize. Not possible, you say, but it happened. A full day of makeup and hair grooming instruction. I also remember a 70 giving a talk at Zone Conference entitled, "The Harder You Work on Your Mission, the More Beautiful Your Wife Will Be." Seriously, his talk began and ended with that statement. No wonder so many of these RM men at BYU are such assholes. What are we teaching? What are we teaching our young men, Lydia?
I'd ask you to tell us you were kidding, but I have this sinking feeling you're not. Imagine giving up 2 years of your life, turning over your body, mind, and spirit to a religious enterprise, and then entering a community of systematic woman bashing. Is it always like this for sister missionaries? Nani.
I loved my mission. That's why it took me 10 fucking years to leave the church. Jenny.
Actually, in my mission, we had a wonderful mission president's wife who did a lot of bringing the high and mighty elders down to earth type things. She would ask pointed questions whenever an elder would make sweeping statements about the gospel. Prior to joining the church, she was a Catholic nun and was quite a scriptorian. However, there were numerous rules that applied to the sisters and not the elders. Looking back on it, I'm ashamed that I didn't speak up about it. For example, elders could go splits, but not the sisters. Sisters had earlier curfew than the elders, but were still required to put in as many hours. Go figure. And we weren't allowed to use missionary cars. They all went to the mission district leaders and zone leaders, but sisters were forbidden to ride bikes. Gag. I can't believe I put up with so much silliness while I was a missionary. By the way, did any of you get subjected to the thing called bind the Lord? Taking the 82nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants, our mission president would say we had to bind the Lord by making him fulfill his promises when we obeyed him. We could bind him by setting a quota of the number of baptisms we would have in a given month, and the Lord was bound to come through as long as we followed mission rules and had faith. I developed an ulcer because of this. Enough, Brandy.
In our mission, sister missionaries were quite autonomous, and by the mission president, quite respected. He would rather have had more sister missionaries and fewer elders, I know, from a few comments he made to me. The sisters didn't cause quite the problems the elders did. Our sister conferences were wonderful. Training skills, life skills, time to watch a movie, visit, bond. The area presidency stopped those, much to the mission president's dismay. I think he felt bad that the elders had monthly training conferences, and this was his way of offering a similar break to the sisters. I think he would have had female assistants and staff if he could have pulled it off. The mission president's wife was much more oppressive than any of the men I knew. She thought we should spend more time on our hair and makeup, like it wouldn't be ruined immediately in the frequent rain, and wear suits, like you can ride a bike in a suit skirt. She also had a contest for all the sisters to lose weight before the conference, and there would be money for the winning sister to buy a new outfit. I didn't participate. I feel bad for those whose missions were oppressive. It's hard enough to do the right thing as it is without that kind of crap going on. I was told by God that a mission was where I needed to be, and that's why I went. It wasn't the easiest thing I've ever done, but I did what I thought was best, and it's over. No regrets. Almost. Millie.
I remember being on my mission and struggling with the terror that God hated me because I was bad. It took a lot to overcome that. For me, it was a secret sin that I'd never told anyone about, but many times I knew that anything that went wrong was my fault because God was punishing me. Are women on missions particularly susceptible to that fear? Is there something in the structure of missions that makes women more vulnerable to it? Overall, I regard my mission as a positive and good experience, but it was so indescribably painful sometimes. Louisa.
In the early months of my mission, I was incredibly guilt-stricken because I was doing everything I was commanded to do by the mission president. But being the wicked boy that I was, I sat down one P-Day and calculated the hours necessary to do everything we were ordered to do. Sleep, 7.5 hours, 4 hours personal study, 2 hours companion study, I don't remember how many hours teaching, and toking. It totaled something like 28 hours a day. In the flash of that moment, I was free. If it was literally impossible to do everything commanded of us, I reasoned, I was free to do what I considered to be important and let the other stuff slide, guilt-free. This was one of the major liberating moments of my life. Tad.
A very important moment for me was when one of my mission presidents told me, with a great deal of bitterness, that he had been instructed by Salt Lake to stop baptizing so many women, because unless they were married to a man who was also Mormon, women rarely, if ever, paid enough tithing to be cost-effective members of the church. Kind of puts a spin on the injunction to stay home and be a wife and mother, doesn't it, Lolly?
I was transferred to my third area in the Philippines Soon thereafter, an 8-year-old boy was due to be baptized. His father did not attend church, but the boy came with his mother and younger brother. Being a little slow on occasion, it eventually dawned on me that the boy's mother did not take the sacrament, though every Saturday night she quietly tapped on our door and gave us her tithing. She had a little store downtown. I eventually commented on this to the branch president, and he told me that she could not be baptized and to forget it. I was there 8 months, and gradually the story came out. The woman and her husband were ethnic Chinese, though citizens of the Philippines. He was much older than she, nearly 30 years. When he came setting up his business in the islands, he was gone a lot and left a wife in Taiwan. Eventually, he bought an unwanted daughter from another Chinese family, used her as a servant until she was a teen, and then she served him as a concubine and was the mother of several children, the youngest of whom started coming to church with friends and now were of the age to be baptized. The issue? Their relationship was not recognized by Philippine law. She had her own employment. There was nothing to prevent her from leaving him so that she could be baptized, except her own sense of what was right and wrong. She understood that her living with this man was not the gospel standard, but since she had been bought and sold, she felt that it would be stealing from him to leave him, so she would not. She, of course, came to our door on Saturday night because the branch president would not accept her tithing, but she had learned that there would often be soft-hearted missionaries who would, and the branch president would not refuse us, though he did her. My appeals to the mission president were of no avail. She was living with a man, not her husband. She could not marry him as he had a legal wife in Taiwan. To leave him would dishonor the legal contract between him and her father. Her testimony must have torn her heart out. I learned that I was one of a trail of missionaries who had struggled with her situation and could come to no satisfactory solution. She was trapped between the gospel's demands and the demands of a patriarchal system that her conscience could not bridge. I did not see it as that then, of course. I decided then that Sister Tan, trapped in a world of men's making, would not be punished by any kind of God I would worship, and I began my first steps in remaking God in my image of him. And so I continued for 8 months, accepting tithing in the dark. Drew.
I have a thought regarding Dallin Oaks' assertion that we should be talking more about taking responsibility than exercising or demanding rights. This rights responsibility thing is appearing more and more in Mormon rhetoric. The problem with it is, as Margaret Toscano noted, Mormon women seem to have plenty of delegated responsibilities. It is their right within the organization to oversee and establish their responsibilities that is lacking. Responsibility devoid of rights is servitude. I get sick of the false rhetorical dichotomies that are set up for women in the church. We can have integrity or visibility, charity or charisma. Why not both integrity and visibility, charity and charisma? Obviously, members of the male church hierarchy don't have to make such choices. Lizzie.
Please do not forget our special upcoming Relief Society mini-class, quilted dissertation covers. Bernice.
Years ago, when we had our first Mormon Women's Forum retreat here in Southern California, we wanted to find an interesting way to get to know each other. So I asked everyone to think about and describe a few pivotal experiences, realizations, or events that had given each of them a feminist consciousness. I told about being invited by a BYU Family Home Evening sister to attend a meeting of the Utah Valley chapter of the Women's Political Caucus, where the Equal Rights Amendment was being discussed. This was in 1973. I've identified myself as a feminist ever since. One of the most memorable images that emerged in the stories told that weekend was when a beautiful young law student described how she had lost most of her foot in the blades of a lawnmower when she was 5, and therefore, at an early age, decided she had better learn to be self-reliant because a man would never want her. The idea that she somehow had to be hobbled in order to escape the handicap of growing up female in the church was truly striking. I'd like to hear your pivotal moments, Lizzie.
As an immigrant family, we always were struggling with racism and capitalism. We won a few and lost others. But I grew up thinking I could do whatever I wanted as long as I really deserved it. I was always extremely upset when I saw obstacles placed before me because of my heritage. Now I am a boy, so how does this make me a feminist? Well, I became more aware of the feminist cause when I was, drumroll please, on my mission. I came to know and love a lot of wonderful women in Chile who were products of a chauvinistic culture. It made me think of the things my own mother and sisters must have felt in Mexico, and even our house with my father. I came back pretty bitter about the whole machismo thing, and it made me far more aware of the social problems of gender, hence my growing interest in looking at issues of inequality and oppression. Also, an increasing love of Christ and certain thoughts in the temple made me more aware of the place of women in God's kingdom. Just some thoughts. Jaime.
My feminism started with an introduction to history, in particular women's history, and my introduction to history came while I was working for the church history department in the old Camelot days under Leonard Arrington. I learned in very charged ways just how subversive women's history could be. My now ex-husband was totally freaked out when I started bringing home books on women's history. I remember vividly one argument with him forbidding me to read any books on women's history. I never would have let anyone tell me not to read a book or not to go to a movie. I have always been fascinated that I reserved these two areas of freedom for myself, even at the points in my life where I felt pretty much everything else to be totally written for me by the church and by conventional wisdom. Perhaps the most dramatic event for me in my feminist awakening, if you will, was the IWY meetings in Salt Lake City in the 1970s. I had helped plan a session on Utah women's history for the conference. I had such warm, fuzzy, idealistic feelings about what was going to happen at the conference. The horde of angry, hysterical women which descended on the Salt Palace that day frightened me and repulsed me, and things were never quite the same after that, surely.
Always on the Yangy side, a pivotal moment for me came when I applied some linear thinking to what I was taught in church and seminary. God was a man, Jesus was a man, the Holy Ghost was a whatever it was not a woman. The 12 apostles were all men, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, etc. were all men, even the angels who appeared to them were men. Forget the European paintings. Virtually every person named in the Book of Mormon was a man, the president of the church was a man, the GAs were all men. I, on the other hand, was a woman, and would be for all eternity. This led me to conclude that I was a secondary kind of creature, cherished but lacking in gravitas as children are. I remember leaving seminary and walking so fast so that no one could catch up with me because I was in one of those verge states where if you have to use your vocal cords at all, you will bawl. But I'm practical-minded about certain things, and I set about accepting this. After all, we are not all equally talented or beautiful, so why assume God created only one kind of human soul of equal value? What I needed, though, was some straight shooting. At some point, I went on a camping trip with some kids and a favorite seminary teacher. I can't remember if I asked him privately or in front of everybody, but I laid out my evidence and said, "Look, I can accept this if someone just tells me the truth. Women are secondary to men, aren't they? If someone is straight with me, I'll be able to reconcile myself to this if I have the solace of truth." He didn't confirm this, of course, but I don't recall that he had much to say to me either. It didn't make me a feminist, but it was the end of my attempt to stoically shoulder my abjectness. Nani.
I can imagine this scene replayed over and over by just about every intelligent young woman in the church. It's a wonder any of them stay active, and most of the men are totally unaware of this and can't see why women aren't happy. Jordan.
I think I had feminist inclinations before taking a class from Eloise Bell at BYU. Most of my friends were female, and I remember about grade 9 beginning to realize that I didn't like the way my former male friends talked about or treated their girlfriends. I had Eloise twice during my first year at BYU. She talked about gender-inclusive language, which was the first time I had ever thought of the possibility or need. She also gave tips like, don't call an adult female lady, which infuriated my parents. Every woman should strive to be a lady, my mom said. My dad actually got mad, red in the face. He wasn't sure I should go back to BYU the next semester, where uppity women wanted to do away with pedestals and ladies. While I was a missionary, anytime I gave talks or passed out handouts or read a scripture aloud, I inserted "or woman" to gender-inclusify the text. Pissed some people off, but did it, and it became safe. Even my MP did it eventually, mission president did it eventually. My mission made a feminist out of me in more significant ways. I read Sisters in Spirit, Mormon Enigma, Strangers in Paradox, a whole slew of dialogue articles. A member loaned me the Sunstone that had Jean England's Are All Alike Unto God in it, probably the most significant thing I read for keeping my wavering faith afloat. I started my mission defending polygamy and ended it arguing that the women needed better representation in mission leadership. The first semester I was back at BYU, Voice did the curfew proposal. I quit my night job so I could go to Voice. The rest is herstory. Becoming a feminist opened my eyes to something more important. It made me realize that I'm a gendered being, and subsequently that I have race and ethnicity. Coming to terms with being racialized and gendered is quite a shock after assuming normalcy and universality for 20-something years. About the time I made this realization, I started hesitating to call myself a feminist. I don't want to use the term as something to hide behind, pretending that I'm enlightened and above the pitfalls of masculine socialization. It's been hard to realize that, even as much as I've always hated macho sensibility, I have been masculinized to the core. Brad.
My feminist consciousness came almost completely separately from my Mormonism, and it wasn't until years later that I modified my view of God and the priesthood. What feminism meant to me was almost completely academic, about ways of reading, of thinking, about truth and assessing history and social, ending violence, encouraging women in educational and artistic goals. While I explored feminism, I was in a lovely little Provo ward where I felt accepted and where even the bishop gave me space while still giving me callings. I prayed constantly about everything I was learning and felt confirmed and encouraged. I don't ever remember being angry at God, as a few of you have said. Of course, now I am very angry at patriarchal institutions that undermine women, but I don't feel that it affects my truths much. And Mother in Heaven has been a happy addition to my theology, but not a sea-changing one. Anyone have similar feminist awakenings? I feel I am in the minority. Maybe it's because my Mormonism was only ever vaguely cultural. Sylvia.
I actually have given this a fair amount of thought. Two pivotal moments come to mind. One was when I read From Housewife to Heretic about 4 years ago. That led into the second pivotal moment. I realized that the majority of important people in my life were female, including my wife, daughter, mother, and two very best friends. I wanted life to be as fair for them as it was for me. I have not been the same person ever since. Greg.
There are a few pivotal moments for me, although I think that I was practically born a feminist and have just grown into it as I've grown up. The first consciousness raising I can remember happened during Jimmy Carter's election campaign. One of my mom's friends enlisted her and me to go door-to-door passing out flyers. This friend was a really interesting woman, and I was intrigued and impressed by her. She was Mormon, but had none of the qualities I associated with the women I knew at church. She was big, not just fat, but very, really large-boned and strong, and loud and incredibly opinionated and very political. I think my father's acceptance of her and friendship with her, too, was crucial in my allowing this kind of woman to fit into my idea of what a woman and a Mormon woman could be like. It was one of the few times I saw my mom involved in anything outside of our house or church, and that was important for me, too. My father gave me a copy of Mormon Sisters, and I read it in the back seat of a car on the way to Salt Lake. Driving through southern Utah, looking out at the giant desert and the tiny towns clinging to the sides of little rivers, made the struggles of these women seem real and important and contemporary, and in my melodramatic 10-year-old way, I vowed to join them. The notion that women could accomplish big things despite the obstacles that God, nature, or stupid men placed in their way really took root in me then. Somehow that conviction went underground in my teenage years, and I got swept along in the big lie that women should look pretty and be nice, and I spent all my energy hating my nose, trying to find the perfect outfit, and dieting myself down to 85 pounds and near cardiac arrest. I'm interested in the notion that hobbling of some kind can wake up the sleeping feminist. For me, it was finally learning to be angry at the sick and sickening societal forces that teach women that physical beauty is everything, which helped me start to relearn what women can be. Anorexia and bulimia were handicaps that eventually liberated me. My most recent pivotal moment was in the temple when I was being washed and anointed before my endowment. I felt surrounded by the spiritual power of women and more certain than ever that our heavenly parents do love their daughters as much as their sons, even if some of their sons just don't get it. I'm sure there's a place for women in the King and Queendom of Heaven, and until we get there, a place for feminists in the church. Kate.
My pivotal moment came during a ward conference when I was 12. You probably know what's coming. The stake president read all the boys' presidencies, deacon, teacher, priest, but not the girls. Beehive, Maya Maid Laurel. I still remember the sick feeling I had in my stomach. I mean, I was fresh out of primary where Jesus loved me, and every week I got your special construction paper hearts. So to be treated as not special when the boys still were was totally confusing. I couldn't figure out what made the boys better than the girls. My mom didn't know either. Literally, from that moment on, I was always on the lookout for inequities. Unfortunately, there were plenty. Like the rule in my stake that girls couldn't wear gym shorts during their basketball games, we had to wear jeans or sweats. Do you know how hot it gets playing full-court basketball in jeans? Of course, the boys didn't not only got to wear comfortable shorts, they had matching uniforms. I also want to comment briefly on the socialization of young women. I was fourth in my high school graduating class, got a bunch of scholarships, went on a mission, graduated from BYU with a decent GPA, and then realized I'd never thought at all about what to do after the diploma. 2 years later, I still have no idea, and I'm scared to think about it. The real problem, though, is that I don't know how to think about it. It sounds silly, like I should just sit down and say, okay, I'm going to plan my future, and then do it. But for some reason, I'm frozen. I feel like I missed the how to think up a career and feel good about it fireside. And when I do try to plan, I get sidetracked trying to think up something I could do part-time or at home in the event that I ever get married and have a kid, blah, 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 which looks suspiciously like idiocy since I'm single. Still, I can't shake this feeling that I should be aiming for the smog line instead of the stars. Carol.
Window to His Love, Words and Music by Julie D. Azevedo. Verse 1. I want to be a window to His love, so when you look at me, you will see Him. I want to be so pure and clear that you won't even know I'm here, because His love will shine brightly through me. Verse 2. I want to be a doorway to the truth, so when you walk beyond, you will notice Him. I want to stand so straight and tall that you won't notice me at all, but through my open door, He will be seen. Chorus. A window to His love, a doorway to the truth, a bearer of the message He'd have me bring to you. And with each passing day, I want to fade away. I want to fade away till only He can be seen. And I become a window to His love. Verse 3. I want to be a window to His love, so you can look through me and you'll see Him. And someday, shining through my face, you'll see His loving countenance, because I will have become like He is. Chorus. A window to His love, a doorway to the truth, a bearer of the message He'd have me bring to you. And with each passing day, I want to fade away, I want to fade away till only He can be seen, and I become a window to His love. A window to His love, a doorway to the truth, a bearer of the message He'd have me bring to you. And with each passing year, I want to disappear. I want to disappear till He's become everything, and I've become a window to His love. Okay, gang, let's talk about this for a minute. Yes, in the song, all the He's are capitalized because this is supposed to be Christ we're talking about. And yes, this is about letting go of one's ego in favor of the light of Christ. I know that. I'm not that dumb. But let's get this straight. Young women, ages 13 to 18, need their egos. They do not need to sing about wanting to disappear. I'm pretty convinced that Jesus Christ would not want my daughter to disappear or fade away for Him. She is too beautiful. She is too beloved. This song makes me sick. Jenny.
So here is a topic. Depending on how one defines Mormonism and feminism, they appear to be everything from strikingly compatible to wholly incompatible. How does one live with this, or through it, or despite it? Why bother? Is the effort to do so worthwhile, destructive, or a waste of time? Steffi.
Why bother at all? Because there are many, many people whom I love there and who would benefit greatly from truth spoken at church, where it is so rarely heard. There are many women who are hurting the way I was hurting 13 years ago, knowing in their hearts that something is terribly wrong, but not knowing where to turn and desperately wondering what is wrong with them. I hope I can be there to rescue others, but I have to spend periods of my life not going in order to build up strength to continue the battle against misogynist patriarchy in the church. Why bother? Because it is my church and these are my people. Some of us are DNA Mormons. Wendy.
About 6 months ago, my partner, Sandra, asked a friend if she thought I would have left the church over feminist conflicts if I had not been a lesbian. She said no, and I agree. It certainly seems that every breath we take, oh no, I'm beginning to sound like a Sting song, every fragile attempt at identity requires silencing a valid and truthful contradiction. Is it worse / better now than seven years ago when I last went to a Mormon church for something other than a funeral? Jenny.
Mormon women concerned about feminism have often seen substantial changes in their professions and personal lives, but not in their church institutions or wards. I think that the gap between official church narratives of women's lives and their real-life experiences is widening, and that women's awareness of that gap is increasing. This is particularly true for many Mormon women I know who are well-educated. Most of these friends have experienced from one degree to another the transition from being able to talk the talk to recognizing that they do not share conventions and expectations they once did or thought they did or attempted to. Among these women, the question that 10 years ago was, "How is your ward?" has now become, "What is your relationship with the church?" The common thread in conversations is that Mormonism, or the church, does not work in women's lives the way it once did, and that the transition they are going through remains very unfinished. Part of this is because it affects relationships with family and friends. As more than one friend has put it, "How can I tell my parents that I am becoming inactive or do not believe anymore without killing them?" For some, increased unorthodoxy or honesty about disbelief has caused real strains in marriage. Many would like their children to grow up with the good that Mormonism offers, but are not sure if the bad that comes with it is too high a price. My views of Mormonism have long been conflicted, but I decided a number of years ago that my connection with it was fundamental enough it wouldn't vanish. Given that, it seemed clearly preferable that my engagement with the church be active and progressive rather than inactive and negative. This decision worked reasonably well for several years. But it has not weathered recent years and the move from a relatively congenial university ward to a conservative suburban one well. Nani's description of discontinuity between expectations and conventions is very apt. For me, going to church here is like being in a surrealist play when I had realism in mind. My reasons for subjecting myself to this discontinuity no longer persuade me, since when I attend church here, it is alone, without friends with whom I share expectations and experiences. Email is better. I think sometimes of a grad school friend who believed that people go inactive only to justify their already sinful behavior. He seemed quite unable to understand that one might, even reluctantly, choose to quit attending because it simply didn't work in one's life, or because one disagreed ideologically, or just didn't believe anymore. But that is precisely where the women I've been describing find themselves. It seems incredibly ironic that Mormonism is for many a central source of our ideas about fairness, justice, faith, and community. For at present, it is in the church that in some sense should be our home that many often feel most at sea. Yet, though I participate in the church less than I once did, I am reluctant to see us quit the whole enterprise, to cede the church to those whose expectations and ideas are more correlated. For our experiences and the experiences of Mormonism are true as well. Steffi.
As a graduate student in a program grounded in cultural, and historical theories, I have had to articulate my Mormonism to my fellow students and to myself by explaining to them that although I have many reservations about Mormonism, I cannot quit being Mormon as though I were quitting a birdwatching club. They do not seem to understand how much my being Mormon is part of a cultural identity, like being Italian or being a Southerner or being from a multi-generation of professional teachers, and just as difficult to transform as any long-standing historical identity. I've begun to see more clearly how I have been acculturated into Mormonism through a myriad of nodal networks, as Foucault might say. I experience the culture of Mormonism through ritualized practices such as ordinances, meeting attendance, and reading scriptures. Foucault describes how power or knowledge has a great positive force to create, a force often neglected through attention to power that punishes. Part of a Mormon identity includes institutional practices, but we do have Mormon practices that extend beyond the church and temple buildings. I just think these practices occur on a microeconomic level, that it's difficult for us to see them. Through more subtle yet powerful practices, I experience Mormonism through my relationships with family and with friends and co-workers. My conceptual framework is very Mormon in my relationships to food, sex, the body, money, time, history, work, authority, etc. These have taken shape from birth and before, since I am fourth generation LDS. I cannot change my history or my acculturation. I can stop going to church and even change some, but certainly not all or even most of the more subtle practices. For example, since about 1982, I have given up making jello molds, voting for conservative politicians, serving food on flower-adorned china, reading Edgar A. Guest poetry when giving lessons. I can also reshape some of my conceptual frames, but I cannot be anything but Mormon. This leads me to muse over what type of Mormon I want to be and how I want to perform my identity as a Mormon. I'm reminded of Ann Tyler's Searching for Caleb, a meditation on family relationships that focuses on a character determined to leave his family identity, only to find he cannot do so completely. Corrine.
While I was struggling with my attempts to deal with my newfound feminist leanings, I did a lot of reading and was struck by the incredible power and beauty of the blessings women gave in the 1900s. I decided that I would give my children mother's blessings. After my first child was born, I was working and my husband was home with her. They were not adjusting to life together very well, and I was concerned. I felt inspired to give them both a blessing. I suggested this to my husband, but he felt uncomfortable with it and refused. Instead of doing what I should have and blessing my daughter anyway, I didn't do anything. I felt an incredible loss of blessing and peace. I felt the spirit leave, and I felt like my family had lost a great experience. Several months later, I again felt the need to give my daughter a mother's blessing, and this time I did. It was incredible. I felt words come to me, I felt the spirit's presence, and my husband was willing to be there and to listen. Millie.
When I was on my mission in Spain, my companion, who had gone through the London MTC, said that they had been taught there that by virtue of the authority and the call to be a missionary, sisters too had certain privileges to bless. Specifically, we could bless people's homes and investigators who were having a hard time, etc. So we started doing it. The difference is subtle, but instead of saying, "We ask thee to bless this home," I would say things like, "By the authority I have as thy servant, I bless this home with," etc. At first it felt weird to do, but later it felt absolutely exhilarating to me. Louisa.
Many women feel a desire to bless, but feel awkward when it actually comes to the ritual itself. I wonder if this is true to all the training women receive to not give blessings, the way we are programmed to feel wrong about doing it. How could we expect to feel anything but weird in giving blessings? Maxine.
You don't undo those years of training overnight. A 19-year-old boy is more prepared to give blessings than a 50-year-old woman. Liza.
I agree, and it was precisely this discouragement over decades that caused women to doubt and abandon abilities they actually had. Also, women likely fear church leaders' negative reactions more than they fear actually giving blessings. The fear of negative repercussions is greater than the fear of trying something new. It seems that women who do give blessings either give them privately or join with their husbands in blessing. Some women seem very aware of their right to give blessings, while others fear it would be an apostate act. But in nearly all cases, women are quiet about the practice for fear of getting into trouble.
Ward chorister. Now that sounds like a good job for me. Here's my first offering. This is the chorus to a song our Mormon foremothers used to sing. Sing to the tune of Hope of Israel.
Woman, rise thy pennon soar. Sit thou in the dust no more. Seize the scepter, hold of then, equal with thy brother man.
Nina.
I just found out that I'm in big trouble at church. I'm completely numb. Brief background. Because I'm different, in other words, ponytail, beard, tieless, Levi's, and because I'm trying really hard to have integrity in my relationships with people at church, I found that a lot of people call me up or invite me over to talk about questions and stuff. A couple of weeks ago, a few of us got together. We had what I considered to be an open, loving conversation about our feelings in the church. Apparently, one of our number was deeply offended and told on us. I've been pointed to as the instigator of an apostate group. Anyway, I've been informed that my membership is in the balance now. I was asked to give back my temple recommend. I'm really scared. I'm not ready to be in this place, and yet I can't back down from my very real and very personal opinions, personality, etc. This is who I am. I can't act anymore like I go to church and am like everyone else. But at the same time, I can't just leave. I don't want to leave. I shouldn't have to leave. Now what do I do? Tad.
I have to tell you, you have really struck a chord with me. What you have described sounds an awful lot like me, except that you are open and honest about yourself, whereas I am a coward and to some extent a hypocrite. I really don't know what the answer is. Certainly, I agree with you that you should be able to be honest about yourself without fear of reprisal. Personally, I like the words of Joseph Smith about how he didn't like the thought of kicking someone out for their beliefs. The Methodists have creeds which a man must believe or be escorted out of the church, but the Latter-day Saints are not like that. Ever since September of 1993, I no longer believe that the church follows this teaching of Joseph Smith. Otherwise, his words would give me great comfort. To be honest, I have been afraid of just what you describe, and as a result, I have been very careful about who I share my true feelings with. But this is not an approach I would recommend to anyone, because it is cowardly and because it shows that I value my own integrity less than I value my membership in a church, which in turn values conformity over honesty, which is just plain absurd any way you slice it. I would much rather be honest and open about who I am and let the consequences fall where they may. Truthfully, I am not that brave. Bryce.
I am so sorry that your honest efforts to love and support others have been seen by some in your ward as something other than what it was. Like you, I am not ready to leave. I don't want to leave. Two Sundays ago, when someone in a bishopric meeting used that old women have motherhood and men have priesthood line, I said that I thought the appropriate pairing was fatherhood and motherhood. My comments were at best mild. You would have thought that I had called a news conference and said that GBH, Gordon B. Hinckley, was the Antichrist. I have also been vocal in bishopric meeting about the blatant homophobia expressed by my daughter's seminary teacher. I have talked to the teacher repeatedly, personally. It has been brought to my attention by a sympathetic high council person that our family's name has come up in stake presidency and high council meetings in a negative way in regard to this issue, and I am saddened that my doing just what I ought to do, talk directly with the person and discuss the issue with priesthood leaders confidentially, has been brought to the attention of stake leaders without anyone talking to us first. So given the climate, I'm scared too, but I am not going to stop doing what I think is right. Drew.
Well, good news. The branch president announced to me upon my arrival that he had thought it over and felt that he had acted poorly. He has informed those who were upset with my behavior that they should take up their complaints with me. He also asked if he could renew my temple recommend. This renews my faith in people's ability to think, be compassionate, and act ethically. Tad.
You know you're a Jack Mormon if... If you've ever agreed with your Jewish friend that the Washington, D.C. temple is a ghastly place with a piece of architecture like a vulgar Disneyland on the highway, you might be a Jack Mormon. If you agree with Dallin Oaks that Boyd K. Packer is a grizzly bear, you may be a Jack Mormon. If you ever thought that in a fight between Boyd and a real grizzly, you would cheer for the bear, you may be a Jack Mormon. If you've ever pretended that you don't know the difference between Chardonnay and Chablis, you may be a Jack Mormon. If you've ever sung Onward Bitch and Protest instead of Onward Christian Soldiers, you may be a Jack Mormon. If you have a 5-year-old triple combination that you could return for a full refund, you may be Jack Mormon. If you have a beard and more people tell you that you look like Jerry Garcia than Brigham Young, you may be a Jack Mormon. If sugar is not your favorite drug, you may be a Jack Mormon. Dan.
I'd like to talk more about this lesbian Mormon thing. I've just recently started answering yes again when people ask me if I'm Mormon. It seemed like the last thing I wanted to be. But lately, I've realized this is integral to my identity as being queer. I guess that's a standard epiphany by now. The biggest conflicts I have are not with prayer or questions of doctrine, but with church attendance. Even now that I've come out to all my friends and most of my family, they beg me not to tell anyone at church. I can't live schizophrenically like that anymore, and consequently, I just don't go to church. Being on the ELWC is a big step for me, because now that I live away from both family and BYU, it's my only interaction with Mormon culture. It's easy to joke about the gay Mormon paradox, especially if you're a woman. One BYU bishop told me that my lesbianism was not a grave sin because there was no priesthood going to waste. Reba.
I'm very curious about how we develop our notions of gender. I honestly don't know what it means to say one's body doesn't fit one's gender identity, because I tend to think that most of what we identify as female or male is culturally constructed. What I would like to understand is why cross-dressing and or adopting behaviors that have been traditionally associated with a particular gender satisfy some, while others feel a need to completely alter the body. Does it run more deeply than merely being able to pass as one gender or another? Situations like Alex's and questions such as these force us to look at fundamental issues of gender and question the foundations upon which our notions of gender rest. Lizzie.
Like Lizzie, I am sympathetic to Alex's dilemmas in life as she goes through this transition. I wonder, however, how far transsexuality really pushes the gender question. If our gender is a social construct, then isn't transsexuality simply a move from one to the other of our obligatory heterosexual dichotomy? What I mean is, despite the actual surgery, doesn't transsexuality, and to some degree even cross-dressing, simply move the individual from one construct to the other? It seems that much of the process of pre-operation life is learning to pass, in other words, learning how to adopt the appropriate performance of the gender opposite to the one the individual was born with. It seems to me that if this is the case, then ultimately transsexuality doesn't undermine the gender construct, but reinforces and strengthens it. Tad.
All I know is that from my earliest memories, I wanted to be a girl. I agree that much of what we view as gender is culturally constructed. I don't believe there are any genes which cause us to wear a dress or watch a football game. However, there is also strong evidence that there are certain differences. All I know is that from my earliest memories, I wanted to be a girl. I was cross-dressing by the age of 5. I tend to believe that it's a question of intensity that causes the difference between cross-dressers, transvestites, and transsexuals. Most cross-dressers use dressing as a way of relieving their gender frustrations and are content with occasional episodes. In my case, the cross-dressing was a temporary relief, but I had the constant desire and need to live as a woman. I never really felt an attraction to the clothing, but rather wanted to have a feminine body. I'm sure that culture has had a part in my need to go through this transition also. There have been some hermaphrodite children who were raised in a different gender from their genes and who have been content with that role. I don't think it's possible to determine how much of my identity is based on nature and how much on nurture. I think the biggest mistake is the assumption that gender is bipolar, male or female. We all have both male and female hormones and various degrees of gender feelings and behaviors. With the transsexual, the incongruity is great enough to cause them to be unable to live a healthy life in the gender role they were assigned at birth. Alex.
I don't believe that gender is entirely a social construct. There are physical differences between males and females. However, I tend to see male and female as two fairly large circles encompassing constellations of behaviors, physical characteristics, and emotional responses. These circles mostly occupy the same space, although individuals who identify as male tend to cluster at one side, while those who identify as female tend to cluster at the other. But since there is so much overlap, it is inappropriate to insist on any particular set of responses and behaviors from any individual. But as we all know, society doesn't work that way. The responses and behaviors that are natural to Alex are largely those society insists are female. As she has commented, if society were less insistent, she would likely feel less need to modify her body. Tad.
I don't know if I would feel the strong need to go all the way through the surgery if society were more accepting, but the fact is I still have to support my children, and I like being able to walk out the door without constant harassment, discrimination, and threats of violence. We buy into bipolar gender roles every time we put on a tie or a dress, every day of our lives. Alex.
Someone offered to be one of the 3 Nephites in the ward from hell. This is a story for our would-be Nephite. During our ERA fight, we used to give away free helium-filled balloons all along the parade route during the days of 47. The balloons read, ERA, yes. We'd give them away to children, and when their parents would read the balloons, they'd scream and demand that their children let the things go. Kids were bawling and carrying on everywhere we went. Anyway, getting the balloons around to folks who were giving them away was difficult. The first time we did this balloon scam, out of the blue, 3 women turned up with a huge open-backed hay wagon-type truck. They just instantly pitched in and got balloons to people all over the blazes. After the chaos of the day, I began to look for those 3 women with a truck to thank them for their fabulous assistance. They were nowhere to be found. Finally, when I asked a woman who was with us and who lived in Utah where those 3 with a truck had gone, she said, oh, you mean the 3 Nephites? No one ever knows where they go. Surely you know that. And did you notice that they didn't even leave a tire track in the dirt? So the next year we were back to do our balloon scam again, and when I saw the 3 with the truck, I said, before you disappear again, I want to thank you for your help this year and last, Nephites. One said, yeah, well, we can't just stick around being the Nephites and all. I wanted us to get T-shirts made up that say Nephite number 1, Nephite number 2, and Nephite number 3, you know, but we always get in fights about who has to be number 2, and it just never settled. We never settle the fight. So, no shirts. Alpha.
Okay, I'll confess. I have this fascination with 3 Nephite stories. I view email friends as cut from the same fabric. They show up when you need them and leave without a trace. Ken.
It's the hearts and minds of people that email exposes. This is wonderful and warm and a much more life-enhancing method of communicating. Kathy.
I agree with you, but also I'm afraid of a cyber world where contact through email and other electronic mediums replaces human contact instead of supplements it. Lydia.
I'm not afraid. I think when human contact does take place, that it will be so much better because a lot of the preliminary will be out of the way. Besides that, look at the gaps that can be bridged. Old ladies like me can make friends with young ladies like you. The fat, the thin, the gay, the straight, the ins and outs, the rich and poor. We can skip those barriers and look into minds and hearts. Bye.